This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Violet Microphones at violetusa.com and supported by Omnia Audio on the web at omniaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert. Wow, everybody's dropping the ball today. Do they know who you are, well, Mr. Harnack?
So, are any of us very knowledgeable about streaming?
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah, all your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business,
or in a choice hotel in a distant land,
this is Kirk Harnack.
And my co-host is Hugo Chris Tarr from Milwaukee, Tom Ray from New York, and on assignment, Chris Tobin checks in from the West Coast.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hi there, I'm Kirk Harnack, and welcome into the show. We have our usual cast of characters joining us. What is This Week in Radio Tech? We call it TWRT. Well, it's the show for you if you're interested in all things radio engineering, from the stylus on the turntable, if you still use those, maybe the laser beam on the CD player pickup, computerized automation systems, mixing consoles and how to hook those things up, and audio processing all the way out to the end of the transmitter. And besides that, we're the show that makes you feel good about yourself the next morning when you wake up. So joining us on our show today are a couple of our regulars, Tom Ray from New York. Hey, Tom.
Good evening, Kirk. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing good. I got some boxes in the mail today, so I'm happy.
We'll ask you about those in a minute. Also joining us, Chris Tarr from the cold, frozen tundra of Wisconsin.
Hello there.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm great. You always sound so good because you have that mic processing.
I do. Hey, when I do something, I go all out. That's all I'm saying.
Hey, I got word from the folks at the TWIT Network. A lot of you listeners to This Week in Radio Tech are familiar with the TWIT Network, the This Week in Tech Network. And Dane Golden, who is the official president of TWIT, he has given us a date for being on the TWIT Network on video. And they'll be streaming live audio. You'll still be able to download the show via iTunes in the same way you do it now, or get it from the thisweekinradiotech.com website. But the date, February 17th. That's the first Wednesday after Valentine's Day.
Now, Tom, are you going to powder? Tom, you powder? You going to powder the top of your head there?
So that I'm going to have to. I mean, you know, otherwise I'll have to bring the video gain too far down.
Now you did. You know. Show everybody pictures of us, right, before they decide to pull the trigger on the video?
No.
Yeah, I was going to say, you do realize, Kirk, there's no such thing as a filter for ugly.
There's a reason we're all in radio and not on TV like you, Kirk. You know.
Hey, I'm in radio too, man. I was a disc
jockey. But you're Mr. You know, TV weather guy.
Oh, I'm just lucky to have some hair, that's all.
You have nice hair.
Rub it in. Jeez.
But you know what they say about hair. See, God made a lot of heads, and all the ugly ones he covered with hair.
This is true. So I guess I must be close to being Mr. Perfect.
You got the perfect head, Tom. That's why it's uncovered. And our listeners will all know what we're talking about on February 17th. We're going to be on the TWIT Network, which is available. You can watch TWIT Network shows being produced live or reruns as they show. I'll give them a plug here. If you tune in, tune your browser in to live.twit.tv. You can watch Leo Laporte and his gang and some others produce television shows that stream live on the internet, and a lot of them are available for download or for streaming separately over your Roku box. They're a Roku video box. You can pick them up that way, and there's some other boxes as well that will pick up the TWIT Network. You can watch shows on demand that way as well. I don't think ours is going to be archived on the TWIT Network. They're doing all their major shows first, and then maybe someday they'll get around to all the other shows like ours, which will be affiliated but not owned by the TWIT Network.
So when I come up with something brilliant, it won't be saved for the ages?
It will on audio, but not on video.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
You mean when we come up with one of those experiments where smoke is produced, we can't preserve it? Come on, Kirk. Jeez.
Well, you know, fortunately, that happens every day. So, you know, it's not really that special.
Shoot some video, put it up on YouTube, and we'll just point people to it in the show notes. Hey, today's show is about the subject of audio streaming. And we're going to cover this subject from a radio engineer's point of view. Of course, a lot of radio stations are streaming on the internet, but I'm not sure that, I guess maybe 7 or 8 or 10 years or so ago, a lot of radio stations were some of the first people to be on the internet, but there also are, of course, there are plenty of non-radio station internet broadcasters or netcasters. Those folks, engineers in radio, are often called upon to put their radio station on the air or on the web, on the interwebs, streaming. So that's what we're going to cover today. We're going to try to cover that from beginning to end. And I've got some experience with that. Tom Ray does too. And Chris Tarr has been doing an awful lot of that lately. So that's kind of where we're going to go with our show today, our coverage of that. I want to get Tom to tell us a little bit about the packages that he got in the mail. What'd you get, Tom?
Well, it doesn't sound too exciting. I got some fans today and a couple of volt meters.
Well, I hear you have a lot of fans, but so you got some in boxes today.
Yeah, well, yeah, they showed up in boxes, and my wife gets ticked when they're the female ones. But anyway, yeah. I got my hands on something very cool. About December, I got my hands on a power amplifier module out of a Harris Platinum television transmitter, which was the analog transmitter for WCBS TV Channel 2 here in New York City.
Oh, so it's no longer in use.
No, they it's funny. Apparently, they tried to sell the thing. And the United States and Canada are pretty much the only countries in the world that were still using low-band VHF for television. They couldn't sell it.
Wow.
Couldn't get rid of it.
No buyers. And that's not an old transmitter if it's a Harris Platinum TV transmitter.
No, it's maybe 10 years old, if that much.
Yeah. And so that's solid state. There's not a big klystron in here. It's got what power? It's got drawers that you pull out that are the power modules?
Yep. Works in a drawer. Each power module is good for about a kilowatt. And the cool thing is that Channel 2 is 54 to 60 megahertz. The 6 meter ham band is 50 to 54 megahertz.
Well, now I was going to ask you, Tom, if you're going to run your own TV station or modify this to be a CB linear. Just what you're going to do with it, Tom.
Get out of there, mud duck.
But I found some sexy power supplies on eBay.
Is that how you look that up on eBay? Do you type in sexy power supply?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Only an engineer would come up with a sexy power supply.
Oh, my goodness.
But this thing here, it's a switching supply, communications grade. I got it for $35, brand new in the box. Bought two of them, actually. It'll give me 50 volts out at 60 amps max.
Now, wait a minute. Let's get Ohm's Law going here. 50 volts times 60 amps, that's 3,000 watts.
That's correct.
So let's see.
Which is more than enough for this module, because you figure that this is a probably a class AB1 module, so it's probably 30 to 40% efficient. So there's going to be a lot of heat in this room.
So you're gonna get 3,000 watts of input power from this power supply,
and hopefully get 1,000 watts out in the 6 meter handband.
Right. You're going to apply that to this amplifier. You're going to excite this amplifier with something. I guess you've got a ham transceiver.
My Yaesu FT-857D ham transceiver. I've calculated these amps have 18 dB of gain, so someplace around 30 watts should give me about a kilowatt out.
30 watts drive gives you a kilowatt out. That's a gain of about 18 dB. It'll have available to draw up to 3,000 watts out of the power supply. 35% efficient, you might get 1,000 watts out.
Yep, okay. I'm hoping, because I think it'll be a lot of fun. And, you know, if you hear about this mushroom cloud over New Windsor, New York, sometime next week, you know, it didn't go good.
Well, you know, there was a bunch of people when the analog cutoff happened. A lot of ham radio guys would go to their local TV2 antenna, and they had these little gatherings after they shut the analog down and use the antennas to make contacts.
Well, you know, my friend Jeff Hugabon up in WTIC in Hartford, their transmitter site is co-located with Channel 3 television in town, and he got permission to open up the Channel 3 transmission line after they signed the analog off, and with 10 watts on 6 meters, he was keying up repeaters from Maine all the way down to Washington, D.C.
That's cool. That is awesome.
So,
well, okay, that's exciting. Chris, you got anything in the mail yourself?
No.
No.
Nothing cool. I got a new keypad for my walkie-talkie, my 2 meter 440 walkie-talkie. That's it.
That's a cool thing.
You know, not as cool as the 6 meter deal.
It should be fun.
That is. That's going to be a blast. But especially, you know, 6 meters is interesting. They call it the magic band because a lot of times it's dead quiet. But then all of a sudden you get these band openings and it just, you know, you get signals from all over the world. It's really cool.
And I've never really worked 6 meters before. I'm usually on 20 or 17 or 40. So this ought to be interesting, especially with the sunspot activity picking up recently.
We'll get to our subject of streaming here in a minute, but Tom, I wanted to ask you, you're a ham radio operator. Chris mm-hmm. Dar, you are too, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a sort of a basic license, a no-code technician license. Mm-hmm. Tom, what correlation do you find between broadcast engineers and ham radio enthusiasts?
You tend to find that a lot of broadcast engineers are hams, and to be quite honest with you, that's how a lot of broadcasters got interested in the engineering side.
I was actually different. I was in engineering first, and another friend of mine who was an engineer was a ham, and he said, you really ought to look into getting a ham radio license. And I've thought about it, but I don't really know much about it. He's like, well, you should try it. So went and studied a little bit, took the test, and passed, and I was hooked. And you're right. I think there's a lot of, you learn about these RF skills, and nobody's teaching RF anymore, working on transmitters and things like that. So really, it's the guys tinkering with the ham radios that are learning those skills.
I did the same thing. I was in broadcast first, and part of my problem was for whatever reason, I don't know why, I've never been able to get Morse code down. And so I would not be able to. I can pick out letters, I can pick out words, but I would never be able to pass the Morse code test. So when they did away with the code for the technician, I got the technician license. And the day they announced that they got rid of code for the upper classes of licenses, I immediately took the general test, passed. And then
that's what I did.
Then took the extra test. And Chris is right. I mean, the thing I like about it is you get to play with things like this, amplifier out of the channel 2 transmitter. You can't do that on the job.
Yeah. Well, and here's the other thing is a lot of ham radio guys talk about, I wish I could listen to my, bring my handy talkie to work and listen to what was going on. I can. It's okay.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, not only that, but because there's a lot of hams in my company, Intercom allows me to have, repeater antennas on our towers. So, I've got two tower sites where I've got, UHF repeaters.
Ah, okay. Okay.
It all kind of ties together.
And the other cool thing, I forget, but it'll come to me at some point, so it wasn't important.
I think something interesting about ham radio is that it's not just a single focus. There are so many areas of expertise that one could have in the hobby of ham radio. There's good old fashioned. There's Morse code. There's mm-hmm. voice communications, either by SSB single sideband that sounds like a duck talking if you don't tune it in just right. And then there's all kinds of digital modes. There's voice modes through satellites as they pass mm-hmm. overhead, where you actually have to aim an antenna as it's moving overhead. You can do moon bounce. You can actually bounce a signal off the moon and talk to somebody else elsewhere on the Earth who can also see the moon at that time. And then there's these digital modes for transmitting data, slow scan TV pictures or of course your audio or text that are take place over shortwave and other frequencies as well. So, geez, if you're just a little bit interested in radio communications or digital communications, there's some aspect of ham radio that you can get interested in.
And all you have to do is look up a local ham club. I was telling before we started the podcast tonight, Kirk, I was telling you that in a couple of weeks I won't be available. I belong to the Orange County Amateur Radio Club here in Orange County, New York, and we're giving free ham classes, and anybody can sign up for it. The website is www.ocarc-ny.org. It's going to be held
at ocarc-ny.org. .org, okay.
It's being held at the Goshen E911 Center in Goshen, New York. The only cost, there are two costs involved. The first cost, you have to buy the book. It's $20 for the book, and it's $15 to take the test at the end. They're being given starting starting tonight. We're recording this on Wednesday the 3rd. And for the next 3 weeks, we'll be doing the classes, and then on March 6th, we're giving the tests.
Hmm.
And that's for the technician class license. Then we're going to have a session for everybody who passed. Last time we did this, we had 16 people in the class. We had 14 people take the test. 14 got their tech licenses, and 2 took the general class just for fun and passed.
Wow.
So,
nice.
So we're going to hold a class, how to get your first radio and all this other stuff after the tests, after we find out how many new licensees we have. And it's just a lot of fun.
I got to tell you, too, if you're listening to the podcast because you're interested in getting into broadcast engineering or, that sort of thing, I highly recommend if you go to ARRL.org, you can find out where these classes are happening in your town. And I strongly recommend that you go in, you learn about it, and you take the test. Because not only is it a lot of fun, you meet a lot of good people, but it is one really good way to learn kind of the basics of how the magic happens off the towers. It really does. It gives you a grasp of that and gives you an opportunity to play with that.
It's actually funny. Every year in June, there's Field Day, which is where you go out and operate, quote unquote, under duress. So we go out and we operate with solar cells and batteries and generators. And just for fun, I hooked up a slant wire to the flagpole in the park we go to, and we tune it to 40 meters. Mm-hmm. Which, you don't get to do that on the job.
Right, exactly. I'm real interested in with 2 meter and UHF. We kind of have a little side part of the hobby where we like to modify Motorola equipment for digital, like P25 type of thing. And, so there's a whole group of enthusiasts who do things like that, and we all get together and do that. But Field Day is great, and a lot of times that's a lot of people's their first exposure to really the low frequency, the HF stuff with the long-distance communication. And it really is. It's just really, really neat. And some of the things that you do, like throwing antennas up in the air, and, I know now, for example, my first job was engineer at an AM radio station. I never would have thought about, how to do a slant wire off of there off of a tree if the tower fell, for example. Those are things now. Yeah, I could whip together a tuning network and throw a wire up in a tree and get our AM station back on if I had to. And I learned that from ham radio.
Yep. And it's funny, some of the guys in our club forget what I do for a living. And when we first tuned the flagpole, they kind of looked at it, shook their heads. Never going to work. I'm like, what do you mean it's not going to work? Because I had run the flagpole on a computer program, determined that 40 meters where I wanted to put the slant wire was going to be the input impedance to the quote unquote tower was 83 ohms minus J159, which is not too bad to match. So I matched it up to 50 J0. We have a guy who loves to work what's called QRP, which is low power. So he was on 5 watts. He started pounding Morse code in this thing with 5 watts, and from New York ended up talking to a guy in Hawaii.
Wait, from New York, 5 watts into a flagpole, talked to a guy in Hawaii.
Yeah, and the guys are standing around. I said, told you it would work.
Well, yeah, the ham guys love us because when, Field Day and stuff, we bring all the cool toys for that.
Oh, you mean like
spectrum analyzers and antenna, I mean, it's
the broadcast engineers bring the cool toys.
Right.
Because you got them.
Yeah, the expensive stuff, right, from work.
The operating impedance bridge.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, or the admittance bridge. Wow. Well,
yeah.
Hey, speaking of ham radio, a site that I like is I'm just a technician class guy, and I haven't had the proclivity to deal with the short wave aspects. It's like 40 meters, like Tom was just talking about.
Don't worry, Chris and I'll talk you into it.
Well, you might. but I've always enjoyed this Internet Radio Linking Project, otherwise known as IRLP. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And folks can find out more about that at irlp.net.
Nothing quite like sitting at your computer and talking to some guy in Tel Aviv who's driving around.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, hey, let's move on to our main subject of the evening, and that is we're going to talk about audio streaming. I got involved myself with audio streaming some years ago. Back in around 99 or 2000, maybe it's 2000. Yeah, it's about 2000 or so. I was building our radio stations in American Samoa. Me and my business partner, Larry Fuss, we own a couple of radio stations there, and we were building our first one. The call letters there are KKHJ-FM, and we call it 93KHJ, and yes, we use the old jingles that the Johnny Mann singers sang for 93KHJ in Los Angeles, but however that may be. So I'm there building the studio, and we had just gotten internet service delivered to the new radio station studios. This was delivered via satellite to the island, the main island at American Samoa. And so we had this connection. I think all we were getting was 50 or 60 kilobits per second. But I had my laptop there and thought, you know, I wonder if I can listen to any U.S. radio stations that are streaming online. Well, I happened to know that one of my favorite stations, 700 WLW in Cincinnati, was streaming on the internet. So I dialed it up, and sure enough, they were, and they had a Cincinnati Reds ball game on. And I'm a little bit of a baseball fan, not a sports fanatic, but you know, I can stand to listen to Marty, what's his name? And Marty and Joe.
Yeah, what the heck's his name?
Joe Nuxall and Marty Brenneman.
Yep.
Call the Cincinnati Reds ball game. And so here I was in Pongo American Samoa, proving that this internet thing really works, listening to the Cincinnati Reds ball game with a 7-hour time difference, mind you. It was you know, mid morning there in Pongo, and there I'm listening to a late afternoon, early evening Cincinnati Reds ball game. So I thought, gee, this internet streaming thing, this is kind of cool. This really works. And so we got looking into doing this for ourselves. And actually, I guess American Samoa was the first place that I implemented this. And I guess we each have our own story about how we got started and then where it's going from here. But in American Samoa, of course, we had a radio station that I built, so we had audio available. And so we got a computer and dedicated it to the task of streaming. At this station, let's see, I'd heard of a computer program called Simplecast. Simplecast was a paid-for program, but I think it was well worth the money, $70 or so. And Simplecast would simply encode the audio in a couple of different formats, if you liked. It would do several formats simultaneously. In fact, I think the program may still be available. Just Google Simplecast. If this let me stream MP3, all the bandwidth we thought we could afford at the time was about 56 kilobits per second. And so we installed this, had a sound card in the computer, brought audio from the audio console at the radio station, actually out of the routing switcher, and brought that into the sound card on the computer, and then installed Simplecast and told Simplecast what its audio source should be. At this point, we didn't have any audio processing on this audio. We'll get to that later. So Simplecast took this audio from the sound card and encoded it as an MP3 stream at 56 kilobits per second. We had to disseminate this. We had to replicate the stream for however many people may want to listen. And so the next part of the chain, and we're going to go back and fill in some parts of this chain later on, but I'm just giving the basic story here. So the audio sound card in to Simplecast encoding, which creates the 56 or whatever bit rate you want MP3 stream. And then we had to do what's called a replication server. A program like Simplecast or hardware devices made by various companies, my employer, for example, Telos is one of them, will make streams, but they're not meant to stream that out to a bunch of different listeners. They just make one stream, and usually that's all they're capable of, or they can make just one or two or three streams. So the idea is you have to send this audio stream next to a replication server, and there are several free ones out there that are commonly available. There's Shoutcast, there's Icecast, there's Steamcast, so you could Google any of those, and some are for Windows, some have versions for Linux. And so, in American Samoa, we figured that most of our listeners would actually be in the U.S. So we certainly couldn't stream 10 or 20 or 100 streams from American Samoa back to the U.S. because of the satellite connection that was slow and not necessarily all that reliable, especially at higher bit rates. So we decided to put a streaming server in Las Vegas, which is where my business partner lives. So we put a computer with Shoutcast at his office in Las Vegas. So in Las Vegas, we subscribe to one stream from American Samoa. So just one stream is sent back to Las Vegas, and then in Las Vegas, this Shoutcast server, there's plenty of bandwidth at his office, and so it is able to accept requests from, I think we got it set up for about 35 listeners right now, So people can when they go to our website and click on that stream, they're actually directed to a server that's in Las Vegas, Nevada, to pick up the MP3 stream. So from one end to the other, you can listen with Winamp or you can listen with iTunes. I think Windows Media Player will certainly work on that now. And in the recent past, we've added audio processing to this, and we've also switched to using an AAC stream. I think it's HEAAC, which can give you much higher quality at that same bit rate. Again, there, with American Samoa, our limiting factor there is the bit rate. So that's why we're not streaming at 128 kilobits or perhaps even something higher. So we want to use a high-efficiency codec. So we'll go back and fill in some of those blanks later on, but that's how Kirk Harnack got started with streaming. And yes, I downloaded Shoutcast, and I read the directions, and I think I figured out every possible way you could install it or configure it incorrectly. And that's the beauty of being able to try computer programs until you get it right. You could slowly figure out what it was you did wrong, and guys, your experiences may kind of be the same. Chris, I know you've got a lot of experience here recently, so I want to switch to Tom Ray first. Tom, kind of tell us how you got started with figuring out how to do streaming, and then we're going to get the real story on everything from Chris Tarr. So, Tom.
Well, when I first started at WOR, we were one of the first stations in the country that had an audio stream up. Also, one of the first stations that had a website, and we were doing it through I think it was broadcast.com, which became Yahoo Broadcast.
Oh, so you went through a service to help you get this done?
Well, that's how we started, and it was funny because this was set up in like one of the Yahoo offices in New York City, and they literally had a radio sitting on a windowsill. And once a week, you got on the phone and called them up and said, "Hey guys, could you fine tune the radio a little bit? It's whistling."
Oh, so they would pick you up on the air?
Yeah, directly off the air. And then finally, after about the thousandth time of picking up the phone and saying, "Guys, could you fine tune the radio?" I said, "Could you like get a computer over here and put it in my office?"
Oh, how quaint was that?
And they did, and we fed it directly off the processing before it went to the transmitter.
Tom, now that you mention it, I was living in Dallas back mm-hmm. in the days when I worked for Scott Studios, and isn't that where broadcast.com?
Yep,
sure yeah, they was. Started in Dallas, and I remember talking to one of their engineers was a member of our SBE chapter. It was a young lady. And mm-hmm. she was telling me about all the radios that they had. They're picking up Dallas radio stations for streaming them on broadcast.com.
Yep.
And I thought, how quaint.
And then we had, the issue where I think it was the music, paying for music bits and stuff started up, so we pulled the plug. Mm. And that was right before 9/11. The 9/11 happened, and I mean, I literally got a call from Yahoo Broadcast saying, "Look, guys, please plug the encoder back in. We need you on this. We need to be streaming you." And we did that. And then one thing led to another. And for a while, we do have a streaming service now, but we're using, we're doing spot replacement and everything else. But I run a small company on the side for a while doing streaming. I was involved with a station down in St. Thomas, U.S. Virgin Islands. And I was doing the streaming. I had a server that was located over in Virginia. I rented it through Vario. And we had Real Audio. And I had a Real server set up on that. And God, we used to get about 100 people a day listening to the stream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, the server would pick up the stream out of St. Thomas and then would multicast it. If 100 people connected to the server, 100 people got it.
Sure.
But you're right. I mean, I remember sitting here getting royally frustrated when I was setting up the server because some of the documentation, as broadcast engineers, we're used to picking up the book on the transmitter and reading how it works. There's none of that with this internet stuff. And it's kind of trial and error, set things up. What does this work? Does that work? Okay, that worked, but this one threw me out. And you finally learn what the combination of everything that works great. And you learn a lot. You really do.
But now that you've done it, you could probably set up, some other streaming server with few mistakes. Yeah.
Well, I'm running. Sitting right behind me right now, I've got a computer running a radio station. The former general manager at WOR, Bob Bruno, who retired 2 years ago, he's got a music service. It's called The Best of Everything, and it's literally just about any genre of music you can imagine, and he's got it all blended together. I mean, we're talking rock, Frank Sinatra, jazz, classical, big band, you name it, it's in there. And basically, I teased Bob because I told him, no, we don't trust you with the machine. So it sits behind me, and he can log into it through VNC, and he can do music logs and load things into it, and I do all the real hard tech work. But we're running actually two streams out of this box. It's I think there's a 64 kilobit and there's a 32 kilobit. The 64 kilobit runs through Jetcast, jetcast.com, and the 32 kilobit is intended for someone who, well, a Mac user like yourself, Kirk, because the Jetcast player right now won't support a Mac, or an internet radio. If you've got one of those internet radios, it won't support the Jetcast player, so that's why we have the other stream.
Okay, yeah, I see. It's his website is thebestofeverything.net.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep. And if you click on that, you got gosh knows what you're going to get. And we're having a problem with title and artist right now, but you can see on the website what we're actually playing at this time. And, you know,
it says Blondie, the tide is high, and coming up next, Cozy Cole.
Yep.
So, well, this is you say there's a couple different formats. This looks like quite a variety format here with ABBA, Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Wes Montgomery.
His theory is that if you have an iPod, chances are it's not just the Beatles that are on that iPod. You've probably got Cozy Cole. You've probably got Blondie. You've probably got maybe a classical hit. I mean, of all things, my 22-year-old son has Frank Sinatra's New York, New York on his iPod. I was like, whoa. So, you know, and the idea is this is supposed to be like your iPod. It's not just one given, you know, given genre of music.
So, tell you what, let's go to Chris, and then Tom, we'll come back to you, and you can tell us about the exact setup at the Best of Everything.
Okay.
And then bring us up to date with your current experiences. Chris Tarr, how did you get started in streaming, and what tutorial would you like to walk us through?
Well, first of all, how far we've come. I did the same thing. I mean, we had tuners in the basement and just streamed from a couple of PCs that we had out to the world. But I'll tell you, I mean, times have changed, and you pretty much, most radio stations can't pull that off anymore, and there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one is, of course, the performance payments for the songs. The RIA has an agreement with the artists for a per-play, per-listener song on the stream. So there has to be a way to aggregate that information and make those payments. That's number one. Number two is the voiceover artists doing the national ads have decided that they need to be paid separately if their performances or their commercials run on the audio stream. So you need to overlay that. So it used to be real easy. You plug in radio into a box, you stream the audio, everybody's happy. Now you've got to have these mechanisms in place to make royalty payments and to overlay commercials, essentially, and replace programming. Aside from that, even you've got, some of these, if you're taking network feeds, for example, some of them prohibit rebroadcasting. If you're doing sports games, things like that, you can't restream them. So you've got to black them out and put something there. So, we've moved on in the world to, these pretty fancy systems. There's some as easy. There is do-it-yourself software that'll handle collecting performance rights information and will handle things like commercial overlays. It's not Sam Broadcaster, but it's the same company that does that, Spatial Audio.
Spatial Audio.
As their SOS player that does that. Okay. And then now, kind of the bigger thing for the bigger stations, even some of the small ones, like, for example, when we had Mike Messick on from The Lodge, the service he uses is Liquid Compass. And, he pays a fee to them. They stream the radio station for him. They handle, aggregating the information for making royalty payments and handle the stream overlays. So, there's all those different levels that you can do from beginning to end. But really, for the terms of what we're talking about, the building blocks are pretty easy. You have a computer and you have an audio source. And from there, you can go up. The very basics is just plugging those two things together and sending it out onto the internet, either through Shoutcast or whatever software you want to use. But then you've got, you start from there and go on. Do you want to send title and artist data? Do you want to have commercial overlays? What are you putting in place to make these royalty payments? Now, if you're a commercial broadcaster, that requires out of the box a $500 deposit. for the royalties.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you're a microcaster, there's a little bit of different way of doing that. If you're an internet only type of thing, there's a couple of more structures. But if you're just a radio station wants to stream, that's a $500 check just to get started.
How would a U.S. broadcaster, let's say there's an engineer listening whose station is not on the internet or not legally on the internet at the moment, where does he go to find out information about how to do this right? Not the technical part, but just the legal and payment part.
Well, the first place I would go is soundexchange.com. And that is basically the representative for the artists. That's the body that collects the taxes. And they pretty well spell out what your responsibilities are for that. And that's a very important first step because a lot of people don't know that yet. A lot of broadcasters aren't aware of those fees. And they're there. And it's very serious if you don't pay them. So that is the very first thing you need to do. And then, one of the right after that is start, and I can give you tips on, what to look for if you're thinking about, buying software or going with a service or things like that. There's a couple things you should do before you sign anything. So, but that's the very first thing is learn the rules of the road and make sure you're equipped to do that. Because some people look at that cost and go, whoa, maybe we don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, right now it's something like, 0.0019 cents per song per listener, I think, is the fee right now. It's somewhere in there, 1.6 or 1.9.
Mm-hmm.
And that's literally every time you pay it, you pay per song per listener. So if you have, one person listening, you pay for that one listener. If you have 100 people listening, you're paying for 100 people listening to that song at any given moment.
So there's the software that you talked about earlier can keep track of exactly how many people are streaming that audio.
Right. And
with a timestamp, so you know how many people were listening during a given song.
Right. And essentially what that does is wherever you're streaming your distribution is, what you're doing is to that server, you're sending your title and artist data, and then that server is collecting all the connection information.
Mm-hmm.
So, it'll go back and say at 7:30, you were playing, you were playing this song. And at that time, you had 100 people listening. And, most services will actually go a step further and do all that aggregation and make those payments on your behalf. So you don't have to do anything.
Ah, okay.
So that's really, that's why the services, although they're a little more pricey, are kind of worth it because that's a lot of headache you don't have to deal with because you do have to do these monthly, the payment reports, this paperwork for getting the payments done. So, these services will do that for you. And that's one less headache you have to deal with.
There's another service I've just thought of called Stream Guys. This one seems to be somewhat popular as well. And when you pay these services, don't they also take care of paying for the bandwidth that you need on demand?
Absolutely. Because what you're doing is you're only sending one feed out, and that's going to be the feed to that distribution point. So, for example, Liquid Compass, Stream Guys, there's a lot of them out there, and that's what you're paying for is you're paying them, and they handle most of the work. They basically give you a player to put on a computer, an encoder to put on your computer, and you put your audio source into that computer. You set up you're basically setting up your automation system to talk to that server and say, here I'm playing a commercial we need to overlay, or I'm playing music, here's the name of the song. And that all that information gets sent out to that aggregator. They handle all the bandwidth. They handle all the royalty payments. They handle all that paperwork. They do it all, and you don't have to worry about it.
Okay. So do you have any story to tell us about either your early experiences or what you've got going now? What has been different or unusual or something that, tutorial-wise that our listeners ought to know?
I'll tell you what. One of the things it gets so complicated now that it literally some days I have a hard time keeping it straight. We had a stream go down. We had some issues with routing some audio. So I'm patching some cables around and everything. And one of our stations is a adult contemporary station, kind of light rock type of thing. And then we have one that's top 40, very kind of rap based and things like that. And I crossed the streams, and that was a bad thing.
Oh, so all of a sudden, streams.
Right. So all of a sudden, you got these office workers, listening to the adult contemporary station, at work, and then blaring through their speakers came like a Jay-Z song or some kind of really almost hardcore rap song. I had no clue. I just, I was plugging things up and I wasn't really, paying attention. And it was like that for about 20 minutes until somebody said, yeah, we're getting a lot of calls. I was like, oh, whoops. So, you know, it used to be easy because it's just you had a computer and a radio connected to it. And now, you know, there's processing considerations. There's absolutely the overlay considerations. And it becomes it is very complicated. A lot of people think it's throwing up a stream is, it's pretty easy. But, you know, when you see really how it's done appropriately, there's a lot of work to it. It really is.
Wow. I was going to mention that there seems to be a lot of interest in streaming and make sure they're doing it right on coming from the directors of engineering of quite a few U.S. broadcasters. I mean, the big guys, the CBSs and the Intercoms and the Buckleys and even down to the South Seas broadcastings of the world. People are realizing they've got to have their stream out there, especially as mobile connectivity will really take off in the next 5 years. We'll have broadband in the car and let you tune into whatever you want. And broadcasters hoping, well, I sure hope they stick with us for local weather and news and school closings and that kind of thing.
I'll tell you what, I am under my directive from our corporate parent is that we treat our on-air streams like we do a transmitter. If we're down, it's that kind of an emergency to get the stream back up. Because we do. We actually have a separate feed for mobile devices. And so we increased our bandwidth to, for better experience. And, we have thousands of people listening to the stream. So we do. And now with PPM, with Arbitron, you encode your streams for ratings.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I am instructed that, and I have silent sensors on the streams and I have different metrics and alarms to let me know if there's an issue with it. And it is. It's treated like an off-air emergency.
And not just in the U.S., but I work for Telos and we make software and hardware that does streaming. We make a piece of hardware called the iPort, which can create 16 streams all at the same time.
Yeah, Apple would like to talk to you. They're lawyers. Oh. the i what?
Oh. It's not the iPad or the iPod. It's the iPort, and we make audio processors that do eight times processing for eight streams, and we make some software too. That there's a new one that we have just been playing with called Omnia AXE. It's the Omnia AX software plus encoding. And in fact, just the other day, I've got kind of a kick butt computer here under my desk, and I was running 20 instances of Omnia AXE there. So I was doing multiband audio processing and HEAAC encoding times 20 on this one machine, and it was getting about a 35% or 40% load on the CPU.
Here's something really odd. When I was putting in the PPM encoding and decoding equipment, I had to go out and buy three, because I have three stations, three web radios, internet web radios, so that I could feed the stream into the Arbitron monitors, so I could tell if the encoding is working or not.
Oh, okay. So you have to grab audio back out of it.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole other world that you're having to get into with this. I mean, just that you would never have to deal with before.
Well, at least there's not quite the same issues of a parcel of land and a 800-foot tower.
Right. Well, exactly. It's funny that I worked for a guy. And this probably was 1996 or 97. At the time I thought he was crazy, but he had all of his programmers get together. This is before I was in engineering and I was on the air in programming. He called us all together and had this big, 2-day summit. What if there were no radio towers? He really, at that time even said, the future is internet. And, what are you going to do when the world changes and, you're not competing with just other radio signals in the market. You're competing with all this available internet streams. And, at the time I went, oh, yeah, whatever. And, it turns out the guy was, ahead of his time on that.
Tom, what were you about to say?
Nothing. I'm just sitting here.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought you were chiming in. Continuing with interest around the world, my function as the international sales manager for Telos, we're getting requests now from other countries wanting to get solutions to stream 20, 25, 30, 100 streams from a location. They want to do proper audio processing and encoding of 100 streams. They're microcasting, very niche formats for, and this is for, for a country of 20 million people. So, there's a lot of interest out there in streaming, sure is. What else did I want to? Oh yeah, we mentioned Sound Exchange, and for those interested in micro webcasting, you know, if you're just wanting to do this at home and play with it yourself, you know, go to Sound Exchange. We'll have all these other websites in the show notes of today's show, Tort number 18, about streaming. I wanted to mention a couple of streaming broadcasters that have particularly good sounding streams. And of course, a lot of my background is in audio processing. And some years ago, back when the internet was fairly young, at least to consumers, I was listening to radio stations that were being streamed on on Reel, on the Reel audio encoder and audio player. And they were, the bit rate was low, and we were using dial up, and they sounded just awful. And so this is long before I worked with Frank Foti at Omnia, or at the time Cutting Edge. I had lunch with Frank one day in Cleveland, Ohio, and I said, "Frank, have you listened to this this internet radio thing?" He says, "Yeah, I've listened to this." I said, "Kind of low bit rates, yeah." I said, "Yeah, it's what we got right now." I said, "It sounds like crap, doesn't it?" He said, "Yeah, it really does. They sound bad." And so I wouldn't pretend to be the inspiration for Frank thinking about this, but I said, "Frank, do you think there's anything that you could invent to process this audio in some way before it got encoded so that maybe it would sound better at the other end where it gets decoded? You know, TV transmitters, for example, do pre-distortion of mm-hmm. the waveform so that it comes out right in the wash, comes out right at the antenna." And so Frank got to thinking about that and came up with some observations about audio processing for streaming. And for our listeners, I'll just give you the important points that we found out.
Yeah, can I interrupt you real quick? I just want to let you know Chris sure. Tobin is here.
Oh yeah, good.
You couldn't see him, but he just sent me a message that he was available.
Good deal. Well, you know what? I wasn't very good about watching out for him. So let's bring Chris Tobin into the phone call here. Da-da-da-da. Let's see. Hang on just a second, Chris. I'm looking for you. Da-da-da-da. Where are you? Oh, I see. We can edit this out if we want to, you know, this part.
I'll fix it in post.
Mumble bumbling, you know, here. Let's see if we can bring Chris Tobin on in. Chris is in Carlsbad, California at the moment. Hey, Chris.
Hello. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and everyone else?
Very cool.
We're good. We're good. We were just talking about streaming, and we were talking about some of our early experiences in streaming audio on the internet, and then Tom told us about his early experiences about his internet service provider picking up WOR with a radio, and then Chris Tarr reminded us about some of the legalities involved, that even for micro webcasters, there is perhaps some money to be paid and some forms to be signed.
Yes, that's true.
And then I was just talking about the huge number of broadcasters and netcasters around the world who are now interested in getting set up for streaming. Here with my job at Telos, I'm getting requests of upwards of 100. How do we stream 100 different streams? Not to 100 listeners, but 100 different programs to stream out from one location. So we're setting people up with audio processing software and the encoders to get that done. And then a lot of folks are using the open source solutions like Shoutcast to do the replication serving. Chris, why don't you fill us in? What was your early experience with streaming? How did you get that set up? And if you want to take us through any of the important tutorial points that you think you want to mention to us, go ahead and do that.
Some of my early streaming experience started at one of the major networks, radio networks, where we started experimenting with different codecs. Because of our affiliations with radio stations across the country, we were trying to find ways to, find non-traditional revenue, as it's called today. And we discovered that bandwidth is definitely finite, but you have to sort of package it a certain way. And one thing we did discover was the codecs, when trying to process the audio to create a stream, you definitely had to condition it or precondition the audio. And then years later, as I worked at several radio stations, we ran into the problems with licensing, commercials, after contracts with commercial reads by disc jockeys or production folks. And so overall, I think if the best time now is streaming, netcasting, if you want to call it that, the trick is just to make sure you pay attention to the details. One, use audio, make sure it's the best quality audio you can stick into the pipe, if you will. Process it properly, so definitely get yourself a nice software codec that can give you some a decent audio level control. I don't think you have to go crazy with 27 multiple bands of audio processing.
No.
But definitely something that's consistent. And the other thing is just think of the end user. What is it, the goal? What are you trying to get out of it? You know, the person that dials into your stream, what exactly do you want them to, what's their expectation should be? Because that's one thing I will say, radio stations I've worked for over the years, nobody thought of that part. It was like, quick, get the music on this thing, the internet, and let's go.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you sit there with a website and a streaming link, and people standing going, okay, I can do this with the radio too.
Okay.
Yeah. Think about it. It's true.
Yeah.
You know, the metadata capabilities today and the players and the skins, you can do a lot more than just simply play music or talk to somebody.
Sure. Sure. And in fact, Chris Tarr, you were mentioning some software solutions to get this metadata put together. The metadata, this is where your stream player can show you title and artist, and maybe even can show you a picture of the artist as the song is streaming down. I'm looking forward to the day when, just like we were talking about with HD radio in your car, if you're listening to a baseball game, you'd be able to see a picture of who was at bat. Visible,
sure.
You know, not to the driver, of course, but to the passengers, and we show you their batting average, even show you the ball and strike count at the time.
Sure. Well, you know, there's of course there's Broadcast Electronics BE. They have their TRE software, and then the guy, the inventor, the daddy of TRE, Alan Hartle just came out with new software called Jump to Go. I know Harris has their own software too. And what these do is these are kind of aggregators, and they scrape the data from your automation system and they send it off to your streaming. In fact, now they can do Twitter, so you can have a Twitter feed of what's currently playing on your radio station. But really, it all boils down to having your automation system talk to your streaming system. And all current, in fairly recent automation systems send that data. And what you need is you just need some software to kind of decode what that's saying and put it in the format that the different devices like. And, I usually prefer to go with the TREs of the world that really, you just send it one feed and it distributes it to your website, to your RDS, to your HD radio for pad data. To the streaming services, and it does all that for you, so you don't have to worry about it. And generally, what it does is it takes a title artist, looks it up on a database, grabs the album art from Amazon or whatever, and then sends it on its way. And there's a lot of ways to do that, but some of those software solutions really give you some pretty interesting capabilities. Like I said, the Twitter thing, I think is kind of an interesting use for Twitter. It takes it every time you play a new song, it posts a tweet on a Twitter account.
Well, I want 14 new tweets every hour with the song.
Well, I'll tell you what though, if you have if you have people who are real loyal to your radio station, love your music, it's a great way for them to find out what you're playing.
I'd like for them to tweet just a few seconds before the contest starts.
Right. That's kind of an interesting thing you bring up, because that's another thing that we've had to change because of streaming and our contest rules. Because of the overlay software and things like that, our on-air signal can be delayed anywhere from 5 seconds to 2 minutes. And we had to put a disclaimer in our contest rules that that streaming broadcasts may be delayed. If you're trying to participate in a call-in contest or something like that, there's a good chance you can call in and it's over. On the win.
Right. That's true.
And so in our contest rules that we do on the air and that we have available at the radio station, it mentions that, online broadcast may be delayed.
I'm putting a link up to the TRE. TRE stands for the Radio Experience. I know Alan Hartle had some dealings with him, and he's got excellent software. It is sold by the folks at Broadcast Electronics. So I'll put a link to TRE software at the Broadcast Electronics website in the show notes. And there's other companies that do this as well. We use one in American Samoa for our RDS, but it can also work for the web streaming, called Arctic Palm. They're out of Canada, I believe. And there's some others, too. Chris Tobin, when you chimed in, you mentioned a bit about audio processing. Certainly there are webcasters who don't do any audio processing. There are webcasters who grab an audio signal from off the air, from a tuner, and which has been usually heavily processed. There are other webcasters who use a simple audio processor, maybe just some multiband some wideband processor from DBX or something fairly simple, something that they've retired from broadcast use. And I was going to mention just as as Chris Tobin was chiming in about what some of the things that Frank Foti, through experimentation, had found, what's important about prepping some audio for an encoder. And what an encoder is doing, of course, is it's taking a large amount of data. If it's in digital form, it's, you know, 1 to 2 megabits per one to 2 megabits per second of sampled audio data that represents the audio waveform that was making the music. And the idea here is through either psychoacoustic analysis and statistical analysis or other methods like what APTX uses, getting that data down to a much more manageable rate, say about 384 kilobits per second or 256, or for streaming on the internet, you know, about 128 kilobits per second, and even less than that when you know you're going to have a mobile audience trying to get that data down to 48 or 50 kilobits per second. Well, that's a far, far cry from, you know, the 1 to 2 megabits per second originally represented by the original data. So how do we reduce it to that? And is what can we do to the audio in terms of level, in terms of high frequency roll off, in terms of just prepping that audio for an encoder? And the couple of things that Frank Foti found as he was researching this, and other companies like Orban and others have determined essentially the same things. One of them is the low-pass filter in a computer sound card is usually pretty bad, not very effective at all. And we really want to low-pass filter the audio so that there is no audio energy above the Nyquist frequency. That's N-Y-Q-U-I-S-T. Nyquist. N-Y-Q-U-I-S-T. We'll put that in the show notes. But the Nyquist frequency is basically half of the sampling frequency. So if you've got a sound card that's sampling at 44.1 kilohertz, Nyquist is 22.05 kilohertz, and we want there to be absolutely no audio energy above 22.05. Luckily, there's not going to be any audio above that unless it's a noise that was generated somewhere along the way. So we're really more concerned with sound cards that are being told to sample at lesser frequencies, like sample at 22 kilohertz, thereby giving you a Nyquist of 11 kilohertz. Well, there could well be audio energy above 11 kilohertz. Or if you're sampling even lower than that, let's say you're sampling at 11 kilohertz, so your Nyquist is going to be 5.5 kilohertz. You don't want any audio energy above 5.5, or else you're going to get aliasing distortion, and it doesn't sound pretty at all. It's harmonically unrelated to the audio, and it really, really is a bad thing. And so if you want your stream to sound nice, we've got to get rid of any energy that is above the Nyquist frequency. Now, remember, I'm talking about the sampling frequency, not the ultimate bit rate produced by the encoder. So the sampling frequency is how many times per second is the audio card or sample rate converter or whatever is in the line that's getting this audio to its final form. That it's the sampling frequency of that device. Usually it's a sound card. So it's real important that we low pass the audio. We don't let any high frequencies through that would be above the Nyquist frequency. We'll put a link in the show notes to Nyquist. And another thing we want to do is we also don't want to use an audio processor that's going to do any harsh processing like heavy-duty limiting or any clipping. Now, we use broadcasters use clipping all the time with AM and with FM audio processors because we can actually do a fair amount of clipping before it starts to become irritating to one's ear. But you can't do that with when you're going to be following that up with a streaming encoder. You can't do any clipping because it creates harmonics which occur above Nyquist. And so just it doesn't sound good. And so you don't want to do clipping, so you want to do limiting, and even better if you can do some pretty smart, intelligent look-ahead limiting. And so these two things, Nyquist frequency, pay respect to that, and also some look-ahead limiting that is smart about how it works. Other than that, you want to keep a reasonable amount of energy in the various bands, and you don't want to do too much processing because all these audio encoders, MP3, AAC, HE, high efficiency AAC, all of the, even Windows Media, Windows Audio, these were all designed for normal, in quotes, normal audio. They're not designed for audio that has, you know, that's just a wall of sound that is just totally, totally processed. They've got to find some things in there to take out, and that's easier to do.
Peaks and valleys.
Peaks and valleys, yeah. Got to have some valleys in there so we can take the valley completely out. I'll put a couple more notes in the show notes, not only about Nyquist, but also about the whole subject of perceptual audio encoding, so you can kind of get an idea, listeners, of what's important there. And what's not. And finally, in my rant, I'll finish up here by saying there's a couple of websites that have really good sounding audio. You guys might want to mention your own, but two of my favorites. One is called Goom.com. It stands for Go On Media. It's GOOM.com. They just started 17 streams in the U.S., and I think you can also log in and make your own custom stream like you can with some other internet netcasters. Also, there's one that's been around for quite a few years. It's Soma.fm, Soma.fm. They stream a number of different really cool formats. They're out of San Francisco, and their audio just sounds very, very sweet as well. Goom is loud, sweet, very clear-sounding streamed audio, and Soma.fm. So that's it for my suggestions. Who wants to give their advice next?
Well, I the one thing I do want to point out, and a lot of people don't think of this, and I wanted to, it was one of those things where tonight when you talked about streaming, it was like, if I could get one thing in, this would be it, is before you do anything, make any choice about how you're going to stream, be sure to test the player with several different computers, yes, if you can, several, yes, different types of software, operating systems, things like that, because I'm going to tell you, if there's a bad user experience, if they have to download stuff to run it, if it's difficult to navigate, it's not going to matter because nobody's going to listen. So before you get stuck into something that is just going to kill you, be sure to try it out. And as a listener, you know, get from the company that you're going to, the software that you're going to use, get some references, find out who else is using the software and try it and run through it and see how it plays and make sure that, you know, it's not going to be something that's going to frustrate people, because that'll just, nothing kills that faster than a bad user experience.
Like, you mean clicking on a link the radio station provides and having nothing happen or pop right, up with a Windows message that says you need to download this or
yeah,
that.
Or, yeah, you have to download software to run it, or it's only a certain, you know, it only runs on Windows machines. You know, I've run into that a few times where the player itself, you know, is an ActiveX or something that doesn't work on a Mac, you know, or Linux or anything else. I mean, that's, you know, you could get away with that a couple of years ago, but you can't anymore. So,
good advice. Yeah. Chris Tobin, what are you guys doing at your CBS stations? Is it a custom player that people get when they click on a link?
It is a custom player, CBS player, yes. Actually, it's built in conjunction with the folks from Stream the World. And it actually works very well across many platforms. And we've got so many streams coming in from various places around the country that our processing and an approach to it is very complicated. But it works. And Chris Tarr is correct. You need to make sure the players you choose are universally accepted by those that are going to listen to your stream. Because I will say, when we first started out with a couple of specialty streams, we had some folks say, yeah, these players are great, you can do this, blah, blah, blah. And we're like, oh, that's a great thing. The salespeople loved it. Did a few beta tests just offline. Yeah, okay. Those six that we looked at, we went with some new ones.
Yeah.
And it worked half the time. It was literally, hey, if you got Internet Explorer 6 and 5 and 3, it works great. When it comes to Internet Explorer 7, ooh, wow, it was half and half.
And I guess you got to worry about other platforms now, like iPhones, and maybe iPod Touches as well, and Blackberries.
Well, we at first with the Blackberries was a nightmare because of the way the network was set up a couple of years back, and the mobile phone approach, we had to take a whole different group of folks and say, you focus on this, and those of you here will focus on the streams at desktops in the office or at home. And it was wild looking at the data, and it's saying, it's not as universal as you would think. Not as universal as we're accustomed to as broadcasters when it comes to equipment and platforms.
Stream the World does a very good job, though, of, because we use them too, with doing one stream for their player and then another stream for other platforms. We use for iPhones, we use Flycast. And so we actually send out two separate streams, one formatted for that, one formatted for the Stream the World player.
and it works really well. And you know, we've had no issues with it. Yeah.
Oh, so you're saying that it may be necessary to use more than one streaming provider if you really want to hit a wide audience in every possible platform.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting better now where the providers are offering that. But yeah, so, you know, at first you would have to pick a couple different providers sometimes to get the entire solution.
Yeah, now you can select one provider and they can give you multiple platform access. Okay. I guess
so. You just send out. You still send out. I actually send out two streams. I send out a high bit rate and a low bit rate. But you know, it's to the point now where you can set out one stream and they can reformat it to pretty much anything.
Just looking at the Stream the World website, we'll have this in the show notes. But indeed, CBS Radio's on there. So is Cox and Entercom's right there. Entrevision, Nassau Broadcasting Partners. These are all broadcasters in the U.S. You guys know, I was just in Fiji, the station that we're putting new consoles in, Bula FM. It's also a customer of Stream the World, apparently. They have big customers in Canada as well, the big broadcasters there like Chorus, Astral, and Chum. So, yeah, these are popular guys.
It's because they work.
Tom Ray, haven't heard much from you in a while. You want to bring us to the what is the current state of streaming at your stations, WOR? Can people have a choice of their streams or listen to any shows on demand? Where do you guys stand with that?
For listening to shows on demand, yes, we have podcasting available on the website, and every show that we carry is at least that's produced locally is podcast. As far as streaming goes, right now we've got one streaming provider, that's Jetcast. There may be others in the future. We have a new gentleman working in internet who's working on various projects like that. You know, we do spot replacement, and like Chris said before, you know, there are issues when it comes to what do you do with a certain program like Michael Savage at night. We can't stream Savage.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, we replace that audio with something else, usually something produced in-house. Same thing with Glenn Beck in the morning. We rerun 2 hours of the morning show during the Glenn Beck show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it is a very topical show, so we give you a second chance to listen to it. But that's what we're doing right now. We've got the one stream available, and hopefully in the future there'll be others. But the podcasting took off like gangbusters when we started it. It was unbelievable.
Well, will there ever come a time when you think we are rid of these rights issues about what you can stream and what you can't stream? You know, back in the early days of streaming, when there was the Rush Limbaugh show, I remember specifically that stations who played Rush Limbaugh had to cut off their stream or replace Rush with something else on their stream. But I don't think that's the case anymore. Stations stream Rush all the time.
Well, will we ever be without lawyers?
Okay.
Right. Well, that answers the question. Yeah.
There is that.
As long as it has a value, there'll be a problem.
Chris, you tell us when you tell us what you do for a living, you talk to us about being looking for non-traditional revenue for the CBS stations and how you are into engineering those kind of things. What are you seeing in the future of streaming? More of the same? More content? Anything earth-shaking coming along?
I see more content, and I see information, relevant information, moving faster. I mean, in our particular application here in New York City, everybody's about capturing something on the streets of New York City as it happens, getting it to their favorite social networking outlet, and off they go. We've just started some pilot programs where we solicit folks for video, if you will call them, you know, citizen journalism, and we solicit video and audio and look at what's coming back and listen to it. And it's absolutely mind-boggling the amount of access people have to a phone with a camera, and then access to various events that you just would never have thought of made sense to possibly report on or make part of some type of lifestyle story. So I think content will always be the key. It's just how do you aggregate it, where do you, and the credibility, keeping the credibility 100%. That's what I see.
And broadcasters ought to be reasonably good at that. Of course, I guess you could say, as bloggers have affected the print publishing and perhaps a bit, over-the-air news broadcasting, I suppose that microcasters could have an effect on what broadcasters do. But the point I was getting at is, broadcasters tend to be pretty good about having the tools to go get a story, And now they got to use other tools to get them onto their web streams as opposed to just getting them on the air, on whatever their traditional over-the-air method would be.
Oh, right, right. Well, I'm actually working with three codecs that are used on the Windows mobile platform, and with also non-cell phone, if you will, platforms as well. So our reporters in the field could actually have a video camera, microphone, and go and create content using all these technologies over a cell phone to make it easier for us to get to stuff.
So your radio reporters are doing some video too?
Yes, we're doing very limited because the problem is the creating the proper workflow. You know, you think about it, you have a webcam at your house, you're sitting there talking to the family, you set it up, it's really nice because you're in an environment that's somewhat stable. Try and cover a story, and the current gadgets that are on the street, so to speak, don't make it very easy to take a laptop, put it on your shoulder, plug in a camera, and go. Or maybe the cell phone camera, and you're trying to use that to try and report a story because its distance is maybe 4 feet. That's the best. After that, it becomes a blur.
Hey, by the way, I'm laughing because a million people before me ran across this on YouTube. But have you seen the Charlie Brooker story about how to report the news? No, I put this on my Facebook just today, and in fact, Ed Bucant and Kimberly Sachs already replied to it. But I'll put this in the show notes. This is absolutely hilarious, and for any budding reporter or someone who's been a radio reporter or a print reporter and needs to move into television, this in 3 minutes tells you how to do it. It's absolutely hilarious too. So.
Have you seen the B-roll video that's on YouTube?
No, what is that about?
We've got the B-roll. It's done like one of those late night screaming commercials at you, and it's all about all the B-roll and what B-roll is. And here you want this, we got it. You want that, we got it. Come with us, we got the B-roll.
That's nice.
All right,
very funny.
Jeez. All right, well, gentlemen, Chris, you have not able to join us until late. You're out on the West Coast. How's things going there with the training or whatever you're doing?
I'm at a vendor training session for some new technologies we're deploying at our facilities. Uh-huh. And weather here in Carlsbad, California is very nice. It is a little cooler than normal, but that's quite all right. I'm actually able to eat outside at a restaurant, fresco style, whereas back in New York City currently there's about 2 inches of snow on the ground. So, yeah. It's a treat, I have to say.
Well, we could be expecting 2 feet on Saturdays, Chris. So.
And that's actually when my flight is due to arrive. It's a red eye Saturday morning.
Well, you'd be all set. Just make sure they put a plow on the front.
Well, you know, just remember one thing. Planes do have to come down at some point. So we'll see how it takes.
We all think about that's the problem, isn't it?
Before I wrap up, I have a quick story from this week, a war story. It's pretty good.
Yeah, let's hear it. Okay.
So I had to put in some new switching at one of our radio stations. And, for a long time, I had been meaning to do a proof. We've got, a studio building and then the transitor building. And the audio runs through a conduit under the ground. And for the longest time, the station sounded okay, but it just, the processing never was just right. I couldn't get it to sound the way I wanted it. And I knew it, there was something going on. And for a long time, considering getting a media converter and doing digital or something. But anyway, so I go to put in this new switcher, and I figure, okay, it's late at night. I don't want to take the station off completely. I'll just do one channel at a time. So I go and I pull the left channel, and there's two channels of audio still on the air.
Oh,
okay. Interesting.
So I move that over, and I take the second channel. I pull that out. There's still two channels of audio on the air, after I swapped them. Mm. So, it turns out that, somewhere between, I started tracing out these wires, and somewhere between where it leaves the one building and enters the other, the wires are somewhere, they're crossed, and it was sending out two channels of, it summed the two channels. And what's odd is with today's processing, they all have these stereo enhancers.
Oh,
so there was enough separation that it's not, if you look on a mod meter and I listen to the car, it seemed like there was some separation there. It just wasn't a lot. And so I couldn't believe it. I moved it over to a new audio pair. It's like I'm putting a brand new processor. Holy cow, that's the problem. But it's one of those things where 30 years ago you'd do every 6 months or so you do an audio proof, you'd catch it right away. Nobody does those anymore, and I just, yeah, I mean, it was just like, oh my God, that is the problem. And it, you know, thanks to those dang stereo enhancers, you know, if it had that not been on, I would have known right away listening to it. Well, it's in mono. That's the problem. But there was just enough separation there to make it sound like it was working. It just, you know, I thought maybe the, you know, the frequency response to the cable was bad or something. And no, it was just, well, there's only really one channel going out there.
So what's the takeaway? What can engineers learn from this experience?
You know, that really, even though those things like audio proofs are no longer necessary, these things over time can change, and it probably doesn't hurt every once in a while to just double check your stuff.
Well,
you know?
I double check my stuff every day, but I
didn't say double check your junk.
That stuff.
I think it's interesting. To me, there are two takeaways from your experience. One is, if something seems like it's a little bit off or not quite right, you're probably right. There probably is something wrong, and you ought to investigate it. And the other takeaway is, if everything seems like it's going okay, you obviously don't have a handle on the situation.
Well, you know, why? You know, you would just never, you know, and that this thing is, it never came up where I had to lift a channel of audio, on the radio station and pay attention. You know, usually if I lost a channel of audio, it's an emergency, you know?
Yeah.
So I never really purposely pulled the channel. So I never was in a position, at least with these stations, where I'd even look at that as a, you know, to check it, because I've just never had the need to pull a channel of audio. And so it's just one of these things where it happened as a part of a different project did. And it's like, wait a minute, that channel's still on, isn't it? And so, yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where you just, you know, it sounds good enough that it's not a severe problem. So you never, you know, it was one of those, yeah, when I get some time, I should check that out and see what's going on. I never, you know, it wasn't that serious, but then I did, and holy cow, I mean, what a surprise.
Well, that's a good battle for a war story. And if you got any more war stories, why don't you hold them, because we got a war story episode coming up in about 2 weeks. So we'll encourage our listeners, stay tuned. Every 10th episode is war stories here on This Week in Radio Tech. We got to go. We've gone past our allotted time. We've used more bits than we're allowed to. So, Chris Tobin, thank you for joining us. I know you had to join us late, but we appreciate your contribution today.
My pleasure.
Chris Tarr from Entercom in Milwaukee, thank you for joining us and helping us understand streaming.
No problem. Glad to be here.
And Tom Ray, you be careful with that Anstifier.
Hey, you never know what may happen around here. You know, it'll cut down my heating oil bill.
I think it will, but your electric bill will go up.
I just imagine, you know, nothing but Tom Ray's shoes with smoke coming out of them.
Oh!
You
know?
You never know.
Yeah, well, you know, some competing engineers at the time imagine that every day.
I love it.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
All right, guys. I'm Kirk Harnack, and I work for the folks at Telos, Omni, and Axia, so that's my bias, and sure appreciate you joining us. Be sure you tune in again next week. Tell your friends about This Week in Radio Tech. You can get us on iTunes, where you can subscribe and get it downloaded automatically each week, or you can check back on our website, too. We also have a little fan page on Facebook. Just look for Twert and pick the appropriate one. I think there's a couple things there. Also, in a couple weeks, we'll be on video live on the Twit Network. Thanks to Leo, Dane, and Colleen. Really appreciate their support and their encouragement in us getting that done. So you'll get to see our smug mugs via Skype video in a couple of weeks. So thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another twert has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged.
If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.